COVID-19 and the classroom, plus the murder of a black transgender woman. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Public schools say they don't need to update safety protocols after the Centers for Disease Control released guidance on opening classrooms to students. Today, we'll hear from teacher union leaders about the state of the virus in the classroom. If you have kids going to school or staying at home, share your experiences with us. 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. This week, Florida International University asked its employees to return to campus for at least a few days a week while students can remain online. And then police call it a violent and vicious attack that killed a black transgender woman earlier this month in Miami-Dade County. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Schools are not a primary driver of spreading the COVID-19 virus. The Centers for Disease Control reached that conclusion based on growing evidence from available studies examining the role of classrooms in the pandemic. Public school classrooms in South Florida have been open for 4 months, and there remains plenty of tension over teaching in person, the protections in place, and how well protocols are being followed. A week ago, the Centers for Disease Control released its guidelines for reopening K-12 schools nationwide, including continuing to require masks, social distancing, hand washing, cleaning, and pushing for teachers to be vaccinated. South Florida school leaders say they support the recommendations, and they say that they're following them. Do you have a student going to school, maybe one studying from home? Are you a teacher who has gone back into the classroom? Maybe you've been quarantined and have had to teach from home for a few weeks. Let us know here live on this Friday afternoon, 800-743-WLRN. Phone lines are open now. Share your experiences with us, education and COVID-19, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. This month, we've been reporting on how the pandemic has affected public education in Florida, and you can explore this entire reporting project, Class of COVID-19, at the website, classofcovid.org. You can listen to our radio special, read all the stories, sign up for our newsletter, and you can also watch our television special Wednesday night at 7 p.m. on WLRN television. Now, on Monday morning's Sunshine Economy at 9 a.m. here on WLRN Radio, we will be speaking with the superintendents of each of the public school districts in South Florida. Today, we will hear from teacher union leaders. But first, WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman is with us. Hi, Jess. Welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So give us kind of this a big picture to set the stage, the state of the virus in public schools, K-12 public schools in South Florida. What does it look like?
Yeah, well, one news report that came out yesterday that I think was actually really interesting in exploring that was from NBC 6 South Florida, kind of doing some watchdog reporting on what Governor Ron DeSantis's messages have been about COVID-19 in schools. So during some press conferences and also in tweets, the governor has said that Florida ranks 34th in the country in terms of pediatric COVID-19 cases. But NBC 6 Florida, South Florida found that the information that the governor was using was looking at students under 15 in Florida, but for the other states, it also included students over 15 through 18, or in some cases 20. And when you make that data apples to apples, Florida actually ranks 9th among states for most COVID cases among children. However, if you think about the fact that Florida is the third most populous state in the country and one of the few states in the country where pretty much all schools are open, 9th maybe looks pretty good. I mean, as pretty good as far as we can say something is pretty good right now, you know?
Yeah.
And more locally, more specifically, just looking at the dashboards that the local school districts have created to track cases, it looks like in Broward County, since schools opened in October, there have been more than 3,100 cases of COVID-19, a little bit more from students than employees, but almost about half and half. And in Miami-Dade, more than 6,200 cases. In that case, far more students than employees. Yeah. And again, that's not to suggest that any of these infections happened in school. But, you know, obviously we know in places where there are more infections in general, there are going to be more infections among children.
Yeah, tough to answer that question about the source of the infection for anybody who may be related to public schools, certainly in this case. Jessica is going to stick with us here. Carla Hernandez-Matz is with us, the president of United Teachers of Dade, the main teachers union in Miami-Dade County. Anna Fusco is back with us here on WLRN, the president of Broward Teachers Union. To both of you, welcome back to the program. Anna, let me begin with you. Are your schools where your union members are teaching, are they following the CDC recommendations that were released a week ago?
Oh, absolutely. All of our educators and support staff are working overtime and diligently to, you know, follow it themselves. And also they're really part of the solution of, you know, helping keep those CDC guidelines and protocols, you know, working. I've visited over 150 of our schools, and, you know, I mean, and our students are trying also with, of course, obviously lots of conversation and guidance from the adults. And I also think it helps with the, you know, keeping that social distancing in full effect, because we only have about 30% of our student population in the overall 226 mm-hmm. schools, and our elementaries, you know, are, you know, we have a handful that are pushing that 40 to 50% student population on campus. So I think that is a big know and understanding of why the spread can, you know, be slow or not happen at all.
Yeah. Carla Hernandez-Matz, what about for your teachers in Miami-Dade County? Are you satisfied that your schools are following these CDC recommendations?
Well, you know, I think that all of our teachers, you know, follow science and guidelines, and, you know, they have been following the CDC guidelines. And, you know, anytime that they have noticed that something was not being followed, they've made us aware so that we can try to help administrators correct that, so that everybody's safety is always top priority. And we wish that our governor would also, you know, follow CDC guidelines and actually prioritize teachers in getting vaccinated, because that is a big angst. It's a big point of contention, because like Anna has said, and, you know, even Jessica and the numbers that she was sharing, I mean, we've had over 6,200 cases since we opened, and we're not at full capacity. Much like Anna, the majority of our kids are still in virtual learning. And so those are very high numbers for an amount of students that are in person. And so we know that it is a reflection of what's happening in the community. And if the community lets down their guard, if they're not wearing their masks, if they're not social distancing, then of course students and adults are going to get infected, and they're going to bring it into our schools. But we do feel our schools are safe.
Both of you mentioned roughly a third of students are in actual classrooms. What about from the teaching core, Anna, and Broward teachers? What percentage are teaching from behind their desks in their classrooms?
Oh, we have over 98%. We only have, from what our superintendent has told us, about 500 of our teachers that he has, you know, allowed to continue to work remote. Mm-hmm. We definitely could use more, because we have about 1,600 with really high health concerns, you know, governed from the CDC guidelines. And it's something that we still take into full consideration, that everybody needs to be, you know, on watch, on guard, and protected. And that vaccine shouldn't be a bag. It should be, you know, given to, you know, all of our educators and all of our, you know, essential workers. And that would help with the community spread, because people are not just working. They're, you know, they are out in the community. And even though they take the protocols and the precautions, obviously the virus is still spreading. Yeah. You know, the public schools in Dade has over 6,200, and Broward has over 3,100, the cases are still there.
Showing up in the population of folks that are using public schools, we don't know if it's in public schools. It's just the science can't go that far here. Carla Hernandez-Matz, for teachers in Miami-Dade County, what percentage are teaching in classrooms, knowing full well that those classrooms may not have any kids in them, but the teachers may be there? What percentage of of Dade County teachers are in the building?
You know, we have done a much better job at actually seeing, you know, being holistic about the approach and how, you know, we offer virtual classes as well as in-person classes. I don't have an exact number, but I can tell you that we have over 1,200 employees that are working from home because they have underlying medical conditions or ADA accommodations. And, you know, our district, by and large, has tried to make sure that these, you know, people, these adults, these employees that do have these underlying medical conditions or these accommodations, that they are able to maintain and continue to work from home with those children whose parents have decided to keep them on a virtual platform or My School Online, which is the MSO model. Right. So, you know, we have, you know, teachers that are teaching from home. They're being safe, but they're interacting virtually with those kids. And, you know, we have been in 100% full swing since the start of the school year, you know. After all the glitches that we've had, we've certainly learned a lot of things.
Yeah. When you say 1,200 employees who are working from home, how many of those are teachers? Any idea?
I would say the majority of those are teachers. And okay. that number that I gave you is for ADA accommodations. We have other teachers at different work sites that also have accommodations that don't qualify for ADA but have other health impairments
ADA, that are also Americans. Working from the Americans with Disabilities Right. Act. Yeah. We're talking about the state of the virus and public education, public kindergarten through 12th grade education here in South Florida. 800-743-WLRN, our phone number on this Friday afternoon. If you have questions, comments, concerns, experiences to share with maybe your student, maybe you're a teacher, a parent who has had a student quarantined or has decided to make that education experience all from home for the time being. 800-743-WLRN. Letters were sent out to parents of children who were doing poorly academically or had very poor attendance records while learning from home. Thousands of students did come back to the schools at the beginning of this spring semester. Anna Fusco with Broward Teachers Union. How has this affected that in-school teaching experience? How does it change the dynamic in school buildings?
Well, I mean, we did have a little bit of an increase, not very much. You know, last semester we had about 20%, and, you know, we're up to, you know, very little over 30%. The difference between Broward and Palm Beach and Dade that, you know, we are sticking with that dual modality. It's the teacher has to teach through the computer for the students that are at home and meet the needs of the students that have actually physically come on campus face to face. It's been a struggle, but our teachers have stepped up and have made it work the best that they can. But unfortunately, our school district wants to only put an emphasis that, you know, the students that are face to face need to get a better, more enriched, you know, world-class education than the students that are at home remote. And I find that
what do you mean by that?
Well, they're pushing the issue that when the kids are on campus face-to-face, they've made the students on campus close their computers to not interact with their peers that are still at home in their class. And the teacher has to teach to the face-to-face student mm-hmm. and meet the needs of the students at home. But they have also been directed to put more into the students that are on campus face to face.
Be specific if you could, Anna. What does that mean? Do more for the face to face education environment as opposed to through the screen? Like, how does that manifest itself?
Use paper and pencil, use books, use manipulatives, walk around, you know, call your small groups. Let the kids on the computer work with each other. The kids that are face-to-face are here with you. Give more, you know, computer assignments. It's been a struggle with the teacher because that's not what they want to do. They want to give all students, you know, the equal opportunity to have mm-hmm. the same instruction. But our school district has taken that approach to where let's meet the needs of the students more when they're on campus. And that's with the parents are getting, you know, conversations. I heard from a parent today, wrote me in an email. My student is a straight A honor roll student, but yet I got a message that my child needs to come on campus because they're failing and I don't know what to do and I don't know who to reach out to.
You know, Tom,
doing some of those tactics.
Go ahead, Carla.
You know, Tom, it's also not research-based. So from everything that we have been able to collect and, you know, data from throughout the pandemic, I mean, we know that teachers are not being as effective as they can be when they have to teach in two modalities. You're very effective if you're teaching in person. You can be very effective when you're putting all your attention to teaching your children virtual. But teaching both modalities at the same time has not proven through research to be effective. And obviously, we're in a pandemic. There's already education inequity, and we're trying our best to give the best of ourselves to our students. And so that is also a difference that we have in Miami-Dade, where dual modality is not compulsory. It is something that if a teacher decides they want to teach in that manner of teaching in person at the same time of doing online, they can, but they don't have to. They can just be online with the class, or they can just be in person, because we are trying to really put all our efforts into giving our students the best academic tools and give them more access to success during this time.
Yeah. Jessica Bakeman, WLRN education reporter. There's been a lot of new research, or even old research, unearthed about the best modality of instruction, and politics has been playing a role, certainly here in Florida, with the push to open up schools initially back in August, September, and October. And then, of course, the mandate that remains in place from the state to school districts to have classrooms open and have parents be able to make that choice about whether or not to keep their students online or be able to put those students in the classroom. What can you share with us, Jessica?
Well, I think that we're in a situation where, you know, our Governor Ron DeSantis, our Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran, early on, you know, over the summer, even as we were experiencing a summer surge in Florida of coronavirus cases, they said, you know, schools have to be open. At the time, there wasn't a whole lot of information about whether that was going to be, you know, the right thing to do, if that was going to fuel the growth of a lot of new cases. And what we found out, and I think actually Florida has probably been helpful to the rest of the country in this, because we're sort of a case study, is that the, you know, schools have not been the super spreaders that researchers or, you know, parents or teachers thought at the beginning that they might be. So that's good news. But at the same time, as we're talking about, you know, these letters that went out to families telling them, send your kids back to school if they're not doing well online, you know, the reporting that we've done in our Class of COVID-19 project, which you can find at classofcovid.org, it really shows that online learning is not working for a lot of students. And the students who are struggling the most are the ones who are already facing the biggest obstacles to success in school, like students with disabilities, for example, who often not only get education at school, but they also get therapies like speech therapy and occupational therapy that help them function and move and speak. And so the stakes are really, really high for a lot of these students. And I think something that is kind of the next phase that we're going to have to be paying attention to is, as more and more students do come back to the classroom, that makes social distancing a lot harder. That means that if you're going to keep doing social distancing, if you're going to try to have, you know, between 3 and 6 feet between desks and classrooms, then you may need more teachers or more staff to handle that so that you can, you know, spread those students out. And I don't know that I've seen any kind of comprehensive plan for making that happen. I think a legitimate complaint from teachers has been that in Florida, there's this push to have schools open and keep them open without putting a whole lot of resources behind being able to do that safely. And so teachers have just been doing the best they can with it. And I don't know if the best they can is going to continue to cut it when more and more students come back into the classrooms.
We're talking about public education, K-12, the state of the virus. That's Jessica Bakeman covering education for us here at WLRN, the leaders of two teacher unions in South Florida, Carla Hernandez-Matz with the United Teachers of Dade, and Ana Fusco with Broward Teachers Union are still with us. There is a proposed legislation which would allow parents in Florida to decide if they would like their student to redo this school year, particularly elementary and middle school students, as opposed to having that decision be solely that of school administrators. Anna Fusco, is this a piece of legislation that the Broward Teachers Union would support or not?
Well, I wouldn't say, you know, in terms of support or not support, I'm, you know, always in favor that, you know, to give parents, you know, a full understanding of what has happened and what can happen if they take a choice. So we would hope that all of the schools and all the school districts are really accurately giving, as you know, the data that is needed to show that if a student really would wholeheartedly need to be retained. Unfortunately, I see a little bit in our school district that, you know, they don't always get that out there to the parents, you know, in a forthcoming way. They want to, you know, bring information to parents to get them back on campus right now. Mm-hmm. Like I told you, a parent was told her child was failing and she knows that her child is not. So, you know, there has to be some real strong data to go behind it and has to be presented to the parent with transparency and fidelity to make that ginormous decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Carla, how about for United Teachers of Dade?
You know, it's a very heavy question. You know, parents are always and already, you know, they're struggling with making decisions on whether to send their kids to in-person school or keep them virtual. And I would caution parents and just have them reflect on the fact that, you know, that's a big stigma that they're going to bring to their child. I mean, failing a grade or being retained is not something easy to overcome as a kid. And, you know, what that does to just your well-being in terms of how you feel about yourself and your self-esteem. I mean, again, these are man-made standards. What everybody should understand is that everybody in the entire world is trying to figure out how to survive a pandemic. Every child in every country around our planet is going to have some kind of academic regression. I don't need a test to know that. That is going to be fact because kids are getting inequality in the way that they're being given, provided education all around the world. And so while everybody is trying to do their best and parents are trying to make the best decisions, and of course, teachers are trying to be innovative and creative in keeping kids' attentions and giving them supplies or materials or even other ways of thinking about how to solve certain problems. I mean, there are things that we are neglecting here, like the emotional intelligence of these children. These children are resilient. They're learning all kinds of things about technology, how to troubleshoot when they're having glitches, you know, how to connect with their peers when they can't see them physically. These are all things that are not tested. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to make sure that parents understand what the negative stigma is, that these are man-made standards, and that we're already living in a moment that is bringing a lot of unnecessary stress to everyone, in particular children, because they're learning to live in a life that they've never been accustomed to.
Carla Hernandez-Matz is the president of United Teachers of Dade. Anna Fusco is the president of Broward Teachers Union. Anna and Carla, thanks for your time today. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Jessica
My
Bakeman,
pleasure.
Covering education for us here at WLRN. Stick with us. Still to come, we're going to continue our talk about COVID-19 and education. We're going to move to higher education, how one local university hopes to have its staff return to campus. That's next on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. This week, thousands of FIU employees were asked to return to campus. It's been 11 months since the university's classrooms were closed and most workers were told to work from home. FIU President Mark Rosenberg told faculty and staff late last week it was time to, quote, take back its space, end quote. But students and instructors are not necessarily crowding back into the classroom. Some staff members can still work for a few days per week from home. Others have been asked to return full time. Do you work or go to school at FIU? Share that experience with us here on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or at WLRN on Twitter. Jessica Bakeman, covering education for us here at WLRN, is still with us. And let's welcome Martha Meyer, the president of the local chapter of United Faculty of Florida, which represents almost 1,400 instructors at Florida International University. Martha, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's your understanding about instructors having to return to FIU campus?
So faculty are under a different set of standards than, I don't want to say that, that was not what I meant. Faculty are not required to return to campus if they attested in the fall semester to having a COVID-19 vulnerability. If they did not attest to that vulnerability, they have the option to be in the classroom. They have the option to be on campus, to do so safely, to follow CDC guidelines, to follow our Panthers Protecting Panthers repopulation guidelines. We have approximately 250 to 300 faculty who attested to having a COVID health vulnerability, which means that those faculty cannot be compelled to return to campus. However, they may return to campus. We have an incredibly supportive structure in place from higher administration all the way down.
I want to ask you about that, Martha.
Go ahead.
I want to ask you about that in a second, Martha, but let me get back to just this idea of decision-making and recommended return, required return, or the ability to stay off campus. You mentioned the few hundred faculty member who attested to having a vulnerability to COVID-19 or caring for someone with a vulnerability for COVID-19. And those were approved. Those folks do not have to return to campus at FIU this semester under a memorandum of understanding that was forged a few months ago, correct?
Correct.
Right. So those that did not attest, now with the strong recommendation coming from the FIU administration, it is still the faculty's choice whether or not to come back to the classroom here in February?
No, schedules are set. We don't have the space to change the way courses are being offered, the modalities in which they are being offered. Students registered for courses for spring semester based upon the modality they were being offered in. So there is no choice in terms of changing the learning environment. There is choice in terms of being on campus, repopulating office space, repopulating meetings, repopulating those kinds of things. But instructional methodology and instructional delivery, that's set
semester. That schedule is not going to change. Martha, stick with us here. We've got a caller from Ian in Miami. Ian, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you. I'm an FIU student, and I have one class that's like a hybrid. I think the teacher called it like high V or something. And another class that all my exams are on campus. And it's a little bit weird. I see a lot of kids don't wear masks. There's no food open on campus. And you have to use your key card to get in every building. And it doesn't always work.
Yeah. And so the protocols seem to be not necessarily followed. Is that in your experience?
It's really just a couple select cases, but the protocols are there. I just don't see them enforced that much.
Yeah. Okay. Ian, I appreciate that. Martha, as someone involved with the union representing instructors, what about enforcement of these protocols? Wearing the mask, the social distancing, the cleaning. What's your experience?
My experience has been that they're all different. So the wearing of the mask, it is. I mean, that's the easiest answer. They're all different. Cleaning comes out of one department. We have an incredible setup for that in which things are happening. You know, classrooms are being cleaned after usage. Bathrooms are being cleaned. Major thoroughfares are being cleaned repeatedly. So that's one set of experiences. The other thing with the masks is that's a tough one. You ask people to put masks on and they do, and then they don't. So it is part of our code of student conduct conversation about, what do we do? That's been an ongoing conversation.
The president of FIU, Mark Rosenberg, told our news partner, the Miami Herald, that, quote, "We have taken every step and precaution to make sure that the university offers a healthy environment." Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I do. Every there, elevators are lined with statements. Things are being wiped down and cleaned. Classrooms are set up so that you can only sit 6 feet apart. You know, I don't know if you've been to a doctor's office or any place where you've had to wait lately, and they're like, you can't sit here. Like, the same setup
believe it or not, Martha. And here's what was interesting about my experience, right? The seats in the row I had to sit in, it was one seat and then two blocked off. The row in front of me, the seat literally in front of me, was the seat for that row for somebody to sit in. So it was 6 feet side to side. It was about 18 inches front to back.
Yeah, it's not ideal in many places, but I have seen the setups on campus. I have seen the way they are structured. I have seen the things that are happening, and they have done a really, really great job in making sure that faculty, staff, students, support staff are supported safely in the process.
We're speaking with Martha Meyer, the president of the local chapter of United Faculty of Florida, represents about 1,400 instructors at Florida International University. This week, Florida International University's administration strongly recommended that staff return to campus for at least a few days per week. 800-743-WLRN is our phone number here live on this Friday, 800-743-9576. Maybe you're a student, faculty, employee at FIU or University of Miami, Florida Atlantic, Miami-Dade College. Share your experiences with this higher education and the pandemic from your perspective. 800-743-WLRN. Education reporter Jessica Bakeman is still with us. Jess, how are other higher education institutions approaching this return to campus question?
Well, it's been, you know, different for each university or college, which is kind of what we've been seeing, you know, even in K-12. And, you know, the University of Miami, which is obviously a private institution, approached this pretty differently than the public schools in the area. The University of Miami had lots of in-person classes last semester. The university is led by Julio Frank, who is himself a global public health expert, former dean of Harvard's School of Public Health. And his leadership through this has certainly not been without criticism. But I think UM is an interesting case to look at for other schools that have been a bit slower in reopening because they have a robust testing program. At one point last semester, they were having all on-campus faculty and students get tested every 2 weeks. I know now they have a different kind of test. Instead of a nasal swab, it's like a breathalyzer where you breathe into it and it then gives you the COVID-19 test results. And I know that about 1,200 more students are back on campus at the University of Miami this semester than last semester, which is causing some angst. And there has been, you know, a surge of cases recently, but again, you know, when you see a surge of cases more broadly, you also see them reflected everywhere else. You know, taking a snapshot, and that's true for a college campus.
It was just a couple of weeks ago that the UM president came out with a statement on a Friday, essentially telling students that they needed to stay off campus unless they were there for work or for classes. It said, you know, any gathering, non-class gathering of more than 10 students wasn't going to happen. No outside visitors to fraternity homes. And the president was concerned about off-campus social activities as spreading events of COVID-19, particularly the UK strain that has begun to be found amongst infections in our community. Martha Mayer with the United Faculty of Florida and Florida International University. What about those concerns as the strong request has been made by the administration for staff members to return?
I believe it's a concern regardless of what industry you're in, right? Like, we have staff that are concerned. We live in multi-generational families in Miami. So from children to grandparents to extended family who live with us. So adding new strains of a virus that's already created a pandemic is nerve-wracking, I think, for many of us. I think it's also something out of our control, and we're listening to the experts. We are listening to the science. We're paying attention to the data. We get regular updates from our repopulation task force. our provost is a scientist himself, so he is very adamant about paying attention to the science and to the data and honoring the guidelines from the CDC. So I get nervous personally when I hear, you know, oh, the new strain is here. I don't want a new strain. You know, I would like
I do not want a new strain either.
I don't want any new strains. I'd like to keep the old strain, please. I understand the old strain.
Or just get rid of the old strain completely. Let's get rid of all the strains.
Can go away.
This is Jessica Bakeman, the education reporter at WLRN. I'm just going to jump in and ask a quick question here. I'm curious about the vaccine at FIU. I understand that FIU applied to be a vaccination site with the Florida Department of Health. And I've heard from employees at other public universities in Florida that they're starting to get communications about, you know, elderly or high risk people, faculty and staff getting vaccine eligibility. Do you know anything about that at FIU?
I know we have been approved to distribute the vaccine. We are following the guidelines that were put out by the governor, the executive order. So it's 65 and over, whether
Would
that's
like
faculty,
to see
staff.
Other faculty or even students themselves be able to get the vaccine?
Oh, yes. I would.
Yeah, I guess that's an easy question to answer. But
and
I mean,
for me, it's a very easy question to answer. I think that if you are going to ask people to return to a situation in which they're increasing the likelihood that they're going to come in contact with a strain of the virus, that making the vaccine available is to them is the only thing to do. I realize that there is a waiting game that we're going through with the result of production of it, but I think the opening of the possibility we shouldn't be having the discussion. It should have already been done.
Martha, we're going to take another quick call here from Delray Beach. Tom is on line 3. Tom, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Yes, sir.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, first of all, I just a comment and a question. I'm very pleased to hear that about the arrangement that you have with the tenured, non-tenured track faculty, anybody involved with the union. I don't think every university has that kind of a situation where they have the option of coming into class and staying at home depending upon their situation. So I commend you for that. My question involves adjuncts. And as you know, adjunct instructors have traditionally been hired on an as-needed basis to provide instruction where the need arises. COVID and those opportunities were plentiful prior to COVID, which really upturned the situation based on across the country, I should say, based on budgetary restrictions and layoffs. Regarding FIU, for online adjuncts as well as traditional adjuncts, what is the current situation now that you guys are planning to start opening up again? And how does the scheme of online adjuncts fit into all this?
Thank you, Tom, for the questions. Martha, how about that that role of the adjuncts?
So one of the things that we were extremely cautious of when we were planning for our spring semester, both fall and spring semester, was being very aware and very conscientious of those members of our learning community who were not as protected as the faculty were. Adjunct faculty members are in that group. Graduate students are in that group. Learning assistants at the undergraduate level that we employ in our large science courses are also in that group. So it was many departments, if not most departments on campus, tried to be as conscientious as possible to provide them with the ability to teach in a modality that they felt most comfortable with. So that is the plan as well moving forward, to make sure that our adjuncts who do not receive the same protections as United Faculty of Florida faculty do, are as protected as they can be. So offering them the opportunity to teach in modalities that they are more comfortable with.
Martha, we appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on our program here today.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
Martha Mayer is the president of the local chapter of United Faculty of Florida, representing about 1,400 instructors at Florida International University. And Jessica, always a pleasure to share your reporting with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Jessica Bakeman, the WLRN reporter, education reporter. You can read more of our COVID-19 coverage, our Class of COVID coverage, at classofcovid.org. Now, still to come on our program this Friday, the murder of a transgender woman in Miami-Dade County earlier this month comes after the deadliest year on record for violence against transgender people. How can the violence be addressed? That's coming up next. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. 2020 was the deadliest year of violence against transgender people on record. According to the Human Rights Campaign, Alexis Braxton was the first transgender murder victim this year in Miami-Dade County. Police call it a violent and vicious attack that killed Braxton. She was found in her condominium in northeast Miami-Dade County on February 4th. Her family, friends, and police still looking for answers. There were at least three murders of transgender Black and Latina women in South Florida last year. How can this violence be addressed? Melba Pearson is with us here on the South Florida Roundup. She is the director of programs for FIU's Center for the Administration of Justice and a former Miami-Dade County prosecutor. Melba, welcome back to our program. Nice to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
What does the murder of Braxton tell us about the threat of violence faced by transgender people here in South Florida?
The threat of violence that our transgender friends here in South Florida face is very high. This is definitely an epidemic. Nationally, these cases have about a 42% rate of being solved, which is way below the national average for most homicides, which hovers around 60%. So this is definitely very problematic, and our community leaders and our law enforcement entities need to really take this seriously and step up to the plate to make sure these cases get solved and people who identify as transgender are, number one, protected, and number two, have the resources to be able to help keep themselves safe as well as feel comfortable reporting when violence happens to them or if they witness something.
Raji Narayan Singh is also with us, author and activist from Hollywood. Raji, thanks for joining us for this conversation. Oh, appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
You heard Melba describe it as an epidemic. Why is the threat greater for Black trans women?
Well, you know, as a transgender woman of color that is a certain age, I've lived through a lot of hardships, a lot of discrimination and injustice. And I think what it is that in this country, there's already an issue for the Black community. And then you add trans to that. Oftentimes we're at the bottom of the totem pole in our own communities. So adding the two makes us more of a victim.
Morgan Mayfair also is with us, Executive Director of Trans Social. Morgan, thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to hear your perspective, and what are the contributing factors to this environment that Melba describes an epidemic, and you just heard Raji describe the threat?
It's a combination of many things, but most importantly, it's anti-trans stigma. There's the dehumanization of transgender people, a lack of understanding and acceptance from family and friends. Let's be honest, we've had a hostile political climate, the marginalization within the wider community. But the reality is that it all stems from the intersections of racism, sexism, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia. All these things deprive trans people of employment, housing, healthcare, other necessities, and also safety. You know, we are dehumanized. You know, people don't see us as their neighbors, their family members, their coworkers, but we are. You know, sadly, we need more visual, you know, people to be more visible so that people understand that we exist and that we're human beings. But with visibility also comes a great deal of danger for my community. You know, this has been a very frightening thing right here at home in South Florida. You know, we have a very large population of trans people, but we're also at the epicenter of anti-trans violence.
Hmm. Melba, as you hear from Raji and Morgan describe that environment, how does that manifest in the criminal justice system, in the investigations that happen into these acts of violence and that are happening currently, for instance, with the murder of Braxton earlier this month?
Yeah, so how it plays out is, number one, sometimes people who identify as transgender are reluctant to come forward and give information as a result of historic disrespect by the police department. Now, you know, as mentioned previously, quite accurately, you know, we sit at the intersection of the, or, you know, racism, right? And then you have the transphobia aspect as well. So when you have officers that don't understand or don't care to understand the life of somebody who identifies as transgender and the struggles that they face, and they compound it by, number one, dead name, right? So in other words, referring to a transgender person by their name prior to their transition. So that's one form of disrespect. Out and out, you know, toxic masculinity, where there's, you know, ridicule and not being taken seriously and misgendering and just being out and out rude or racist, makes people not want to come forward with any information that they have, as well as create a distrust in the system as to whether or not the intentions of solving the case are even there. They are, you know, so there's because of all of these historic aspects and current aspects, you have a lower solve rate. Hmm. And then also, if you have a situation where the police departments may, again, look at these cases, be like, it's tougher to try and get this evidence because of all the reluctance and all of that, they may step away and move on to another case that they think they can clear in a faster manner. So, I mean, there's a number of different things that could be done to kind of address it, starting with, first of all, you know, police departments receiving training with regards to, you know, transgender people, and, you know, learn how to properly refer to people and how to treat people with respect. Mm-hmm. Also, it's going to have to be education within the transgender community from the standpoint of what your rights are, you know, what where you can go to get information and resources. Yeah. And also, you know, decriminalizing sex work, which is a, you know, a little controversial. But if you are a transgender person that's involved in sex work, you're going to be less likely to come forward if you think that you're going to end up entrenched in the criminal justice system as a result of what you do for a living. Another way of getting information.
Decriminalizing sex work may be a little bit more than just a little controversial, Melba, but we'll have to leave that for another program altogether here. But in regards to rights, though, this is an important part of this conversation. And Morgan, I want to hear from you first, and then Raji to you. The Florida Commission on Human Rights recently announced it's going to be extending state protections against employment, housing, and public accommodation discriminations based on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. What kind of impact do you think that extension is going to have, Morgan?
Well, I think it's going to have a huge impact. It's going to help many, many people in the community. But at the same time, you know, I have questions. What happens if you are discriminated? What are the mechanisms for filing a complaint? How many trans individuals can afford an attorney or are able to find a pro bono attorney that can represent them? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of questions that, you know, come up, and everyone thinks, well, this is a godsend and it's going to make everything great. It can. But we need other mechanisms to be able to follow through on them.
Yeah. Raji, let me get your thoughts on this as well, this extension of these state protections against employment and housing discrimination based on gender identity.
Yes, definitely. Well, first I want to say, in regards to the sex work, it needs to be survival sex works, the word survival in front of it, because oftentimes people, when they hear sex work, they're not looking at the whole picture. You know, it's a manifestation, or it's perpetuated by the fact that many transgender people cannot get jobs. Mm-hmm. So anyway, in regards to this sort of protection for us, I think it's wonderful, because doesn't it all start with law first? I mean, you know, if you have a law that has consequences to an action, then people oftentimes follow suit. You know, I worked at companies where there when there was no protection and I was really discriminated against and I had no protection to rely on. You know, it was basically just at a whim, depending on how the company wanted to deal with a transgender employee. But, you know, I think having that is the first step. And then, of course, mentality. People have to be educated. See, because I think what happens is there's fear when you have misunderstanding about a particular topic or a particular type mm-hmm. of person. So if people understand our community a little more, then, you know, there won't be so much ignorance involved. Yeah. I personally have been attacked in my life brutally 3 times. And I have to tell you, all 3 times, I was scared to call the police.
I'm sorry to hear that, Raji. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. Unfortunately, we're running out of time here. But I apologize for interrupting that important part of your story, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, thank you.
Raji Narayan Singh is a community activist from Hollywood. Melba Pearson, Director of Programs for FIU's Center for the Administration of Justice, and Morgan Mayfair, Executive Director of Transsocial. Thanks to all 3 of you for participating here on the South Florida Roundup. That is our program here today, produced by Denise Royal and Andrea Perdomo. Engagement editors Katie Lepre, Lance Dixon, our digital editor, news director Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Jason Zabka is the director of radio programming, technical supervisor Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives answers the phones, and I'm Tom Hudson. Thank you for listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.